Praise the Lord. Okay. I'm a pastor of a church, but assistant pastor of a church of about 400, of which 95% are African and Haitian. So when I say praise the Lord, you're supposed to say something. So otherwise, I'm sort of like out of sync here. Praise the Lord. Yes. That sounds more. Oh, I'm getting home. Also, they never keep track of time, so. Because I speak in French most of the time, I get the opportunity of, and I love the French-speaking people. I'm married. My wife, Lucy, doesn't speak English, really. And God called me specifically to the French-speaking people of the world, even though I'm clearly English from Toronto. But grew up in Quebec. So I had the opportunity of going to Europe and touring France, doing tours in France and Switzerland, and unfortunately not Africa yet. It's coming. But I was in Belgium, and they had me go to a Congolese church. There's a lot of Congolese people in Belgium. Beautiful people, beautiful people. But I remember coming into the church, and there was no one there. Okay, big church. And I'm like with my slides. No one. A half hour later, no one. And then an hour later, so it's like an hour after I was supposed to teach. They came in. And this happened like every day. They were like, it was like everything's on time, but like shifted. So I announced to them, I figured out that there's going to be two raptures. One for me and a half hour later for them. But they're lovely people. I enjoy. We have a good thing. It's different. The difference is that they really focus on relationships. So the relationship is more important than the timing. So it's great. You adapt. All right. So as Rob said, founded the creation. We call it Association Création et Science, which means Creation and Science Association. And in 1990, and I've been giving talks. It's just a call, an efficient way, the best way I had to talk about Christ. Talk about who I was as a Christian. And the questions were always coming to me because in Quebec there's only 0.2% Christian. So there's less Christians per capita than in Quebec, than in Japan. So everywhere it's non-Christian, which is great. I love it. It's a mission field. It's my mission field. But you have to, the questions they're going to ask are not going to be about why were angels going up and down a ladder with Jacob if they had wings. You're not going to get those questions. You're going to get questions about Neanderthal. You're going to get questions about the Big Bang. You're going to get questions about how God fits into this, if there's interest, and why do I believe it as a scientist. Specifically, that's going to be a question. Prove that God exists, this kind of thing. So that's what my talks have been about. And this one is a little more recent, and we're going to be talking about a very powerful argument for a creator, and that is the argument of over-design. It could be amazing. I hope I put the right one on here. Hold on a second. That's not the right. Yeah, it is. Okay. But I changed the title. It's because I hope it's the right one. It's the right talk, but it's just I realized I called it Audacious Creation, and I put amazing here, but that's because I was giving it to some kindergarten day before yesterday. And so audacious, that's a big word. So I changed it to amazing. But amazing, the audacious creation is audacious God. So what I'm talking about here is evolution would only produce, and it doesn't even succeed in doing that, but try to produce just what's necessary to survive. And it would work really hard at doing that. But it would never over-design. And we're going to see that throughout, it's ubiquitous in creation that everything's over-designed. And it doesn't make sense from an energy point of view. It doesn't make sense from a development point of view. It only makes sense from a creator who's hyper-intelligent and who's just having a good time. And he's just going overboard and doing his stuff. And we start looking at it and goes, wow. And, in Revelation, we have this scenario in where the Apostle John in chapter 14 is seeing the throne of God. And he's seeing all these wonderful, wonderful things and colors. And he's seeing these creatures and they're all worshiping God. And then he sees like 24 elders. He sees people with crowns. And they have this situation where they take off their crowns and they throw them at the feet of the Lord. And then they say something interesting. They say, of course, all honor and power and glory are yours. And then it says, why? For you have created all things. Well, that's interesting. That means that the reason that the creation should bring us to a submission and recognition of how big God is. And I think the power in the creation message is for us to, we always put God in a box. We can't do otherwise. We have It's the limitations of our mind. So we try to figure out, fit God into what we think. But God's beyond what we can think and imagine. And the more we start discovering what he's done, the more, to give a common expression, it blows our mind. The more it just gets bigger, which is good. Because if God can look after this, he can probably look after us. So let's dig into this a little bit. So this is me in Alabama at the Space Museum there. And the reason I'm showing this is because obviously a lot of design went into making the lunar module. And they had a lot of testing. They thought there was a lot of dust on the moon. They thought there was feet and feet of dust. And they were worried about it because they figured the moon's been around for several billion years. And so cosmic dust, we know it falls on Earth. We did the calculation. The sun, okay, there's going to be some 60 feet of dust or something. So what are we going to do? Well, you're going to design feet specifically so that they can float basically on dust. And of course they didn't know, and the last one they sent before, it turned off when it hit the soil. So they still didn't know. And we're talking back, you know, there were no computers like we have, the Unix computers, but they weren't sending them on this. This was like very much like piloting a plane in outer space. It was nuts. And they get down there. It's very interesting. The first question they ask is what? The first question they ask is, Armstrong, is how much dust is there? That's the first question. And he said, oh, it's just scuff deep. And, of course, we have the famous footprints. And I'm going to be talking this afternoon about footprints of dinosaurs. But this is footprints on the moon of us. And the next question should have been, why? Where's the dust? Where's it gone? It's not there. And then they quickly did recalculations and said, okay, we can do this in 3 billion, 5 billion years. We can do this. Only trouble is they did their calculations, and it's like atomic layers. It's like way too slow. And then you... they forgot to take into account that about half the lunar dust comes from the moon itself. So you can't count it. It has like iron. And so now it's even slower, so it's like impossible. So great argument for the fact that the moon hasn't been around for 5 billion years. And another thing, in that same museum, you have the Quick plane. So it's a plane from 1908. I don't think anybody would suggest that this appeared by chance over millions of years, right? It's clearly made with intelligence. And yet we look at a bird with trillion cells, flight plans, migrations, chance. It just came up on its own over a period of beginning of life, 600 million years, right? Coming from a protista, or, you know, just we all have this common ancestor. And this bird just came along. And of course, it creates other problems, like flight shows up everywhere in all the domains, so it has to keep re-evolving. But that doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. And so I'm never on the defensive on creation, ever. You know, he mentioned, unfortunately, Rob said I spoke in churches. Actually, I spoke a lot more in schools and universities than churches. Late churches came later on. I've never had to be on the defensive because there's just too much. It's just screaming around us, I've been created. It's screaming. And we'll look at this in a second. So actually, I'm going to skip. This talk has just saved me time because the pastor just read all these verses I was going to say. All right? So exactly, we were looking at the 6 days. I'm going to read this one, though. So Romans, so Apostle Paul says he says a bunch of interesting stuff, but in Romans he says this, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made." So we can understand God, to a certain extent, by what he's made, even his eternal power and Godhead. In other words, we can start grasping the fact that God is eternal, that he's omniscient, all-powerful, and that he's supreme, sovereign, through the creation. And because of that, they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but because vain in their imaginations and their foolishness, their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And this is very unfortunate. About a month ago, I was in a debate, a televised debate. There was myself, there was a pastor, and there was a journalist who's done over 100 documentaries with Radio Canada, which is the French equivalent of CBC and TVA. He's writing his third book on how the Bible is wrong. We think it's going to be a little bit tough, but he's working on it. And how God doesn't exist. And then the other person was Jean-Jacques Crèvecœur, who's a beautiful person. I mean, really a guy who has a great heart. But he is so lost. And he's heavily into talking about manipulation of crowds and stuff. It's just sad because I talked to him and he said, I'm not an evolutionist, I'm not a creationist. He said, I just believe in quantum physics. It's like, in the beginning is quantum physics, so you are an evolutionist. And of course I think that's sort of like magical physics, because as soon as you look at it, it's not there. But for me as a botanist, you know, if I look at the pastor, he's still there. So those of us who know quantum mechanics, it's like as soon as you look at something, it changes. It's bizarre. But it certainly doesn't solve the issue that the creation is screaming around us. And he just didn't want to face the fact that it was. And it talks here about pride. That was it. He's a really nice guy, but his pride is right through the roof. And he just wouldn't open. And I just really felt sad for him. I prayed for him afterwards. All right. So what we're going to do, we're going to take a walk. Virtual walk. Stick around. And when you walk out your door, so I'm going to ask some questions, you can answer. So when you take a walk, what's the first thing that happens when you walk out the door of your house? What's the first thing you need to be able to see anything? What would that be?
Light.
Light. Boy, you're fast, Rob. That's the only one you get to answer. Well, let the other ones a test. Okay. So where does our light come from? Someone else, Rob. Where does our light come from? Yeah, sun. Exactly. So let's talk about this sun a little bit for a few seconds. Because the sun is pretty unique that we have. It's not just an ordinary sun, and we're obviously not on an ordinary planet. So let's take a look at this for a second. So we know we see some things. What does the sun give us? Give me some examples. You can be older than 6 years old, but yeah, go ahead.
Light.
Yeah, light, and what else?
Light.
Yes, heat and light. Yeah, I'll get to that. It's in my list, but I don't want to show the other things first. What else? Calcium. No, I think vitamin D is better. Yeah.
A day.
Yeah, no, keeping the idea of the physical realm, not in the time realm. Okay, what else does the sun do? Really important. Yes.
Radiation?
Yeah, that's the heat, is the radiation. Okay, that's one. Color, that's our eyes that see it, not so much it. So, precipitation. So we don't get rain if we don't have, right, the sun. The heat is making the water evaporate, cycle. If we don't have that, we have photosynthesis. We don't get plants. We're not going to go very far, though, you know, I'm not sure anything we eat now is actual real plants. But anyway, photosynthesis is really good for us. That's why we take greens, right? I'm going to eat chlorophyll directly because I can't get any off the store shelves. Vitamin D, at the time I said there. And, of course, this is really cool. There are only 5%, from our estimates, there are only 5% of the stars in the universe that are, at least our known universe, that are actually like our stars, because 95% of the stars are binary. They have two stars, which would be really uncomfortable for us on Earth, honestly. It would rip us up out, sort of. And we'd end up having an orbit too far away. Very rare, and it's a stable star. Now, it's not stable enough for the evolutionist. They want a star that's so stable that the heat really doesn't change over 5 billion years, which is a really big deal. And it's a paradox. It's a known paradox. It's an issue because it should be different. And, of course, if it's different, we're really specific about having liquid water to make life available on Earth, and it takes a specific temperature, and the sun isn't going to be giving the same amount of heat for 5 billion years. It's going to change. And then we'd be frozen or too hot, so like Venus or Mars. So that's pretty interesting that we're very specific in that, and we're at the exact distance from the Earth for liquid water. And, of course, God wants us to discover Him. In fact, He's pre-programmed us to be able to discover Him. You know, if I show if you look in a river and you see some pebbles and then there's an Indian arrowhead, it's made of the same rock, you don't have to have a university course to know that that's an Indian arrowhead and that's made with intelligence. You know it. Now, how do you know it? Because it's pre-programmed. You're pre-programmed to recognize intelligence. Animals don't recognize intelligence. You're pre-programmed. And why? Because the Creator wants you to discover Him. It's a real issue. It's an issue for the evolutionists because they say themselves, biology is the study of things that have the appearance of being designed with a purpose. Dawkins. Well, the sense is okay except the word appearance. If it looks like it's designed with a purpose, probably because it is designed with a purpose. So, everybody has that issue. How much time do we have? We go to 15, eh? Half hour?
Yeah.
Okay, I was going to show you the I will. I'll show you the first. Just we won't go through the whole thing about the eclipse, but the lunar eclipse. I want to show you just the beginning. Just listen to what the commentator says, because they have to replace God. Okay, just listen. I won't go through all of it because we don't have time. Let's see if we can get sound. Oh, didn't play. Let's try it. Doesn't play. Oh, we got to fix that before the dinosaur talk. I took off the room key. But didn't you put that on your... Yeah, but it's all in PowerPoint. It's embedded. Yeah, so it's not working. All right. Oh, that's good. Oh, there it is.
A solar eclipse happens when a new moon moves between the Earth and the Sun, blocking some or all of the Sun's rays from reaching the Earth. By cosmic chance, even though the Sun is 400 times wider than the moon, it's also 400 times farther away.
Okay, so you heard that? By cosmic chance. And then they talk about how it's just the right distance so we can see the sun and we observe it. And then they go through all the explanations and the details. By cosmic chance. Wow. Cosmic chance does a lot of things. Okay. So the sun is 98% of the mass of the solar system, which is an issue in itself. It has all kinds of issues about how you can get coalescing. And basically Jupiter and Saturn are big vacuums to keep stuff from coming in the inner circle where we're in so that we don't get bombarded with too much of dust. Cosmic issues and asteroids and stuff. Earth is really small. And you on Earth... Okay. So, the significance here is the fact that God loves us, because we're really insignificant in the universe, honestly. But God made this thing for us. Clearly, He made it for us. And there's all kinds of things about spinning and angular momentum. Their model is that they have this like disk of dust that's supposed to coalesce. It doesn't work. We're not spinning. We're not in the right angle. The planets aren't all turning in the right direction. I mean, there's so many things that are wrong with that model, including the fact that dust doesn't just keep coalescing. You do get dust, like under your bed. Well, if you don't vacuum very often, you get little dust bunnies. Yeah, right. You get things, and they can build up to about a meter. That's really, really dusty. you get in space, but between a meter and like 100 kilometers, there's nothing. There's nothing that happens because it breaks apart itself. It doesn't have the strength, forces necessary to hold together. And they know it's a problem. From 100 kilometers, you can do that, but you have to have like 100 kilometers, like, boom! How do you get that? By cosmic chance. Now, what I think is cool about the sun is the sun is beautiful. Who made beautiful? Evolution doesn't touch beautiful. But God made beautiful, and we're made in His image. Okay, let's keep going with our walk. So, something else we see would be insects. And, of course, I want to talk a few minutes about bees. So, bees have to communicate. Bees have to go get, they have scouts, and they go to get the pollen. They go to get the nectar, excuse me. They go to get the nectar to make what? What do they make? Honey, great. So, they go there, and you can imagine if you have one clover plant, and you've sent 200 bees, there's going to be a problem. But you don't see that, do you? You see one, two bees going around. How do they know where to send the bees? How do they know that? How do they know how many bees to send? How do they know where it is in the direction? Because the bees that are going to collect it aren't the scouts. They're at the hive, and they take off, and they watch the scout, and they know to go. So the communication that takes place here is at distance, direction, and quantity. So how do they do that? They dance. Okay, a little bit of levity. Okay. So bees are just as organized as this. They do the distance, and they do the direction relative to the sun. So let's look at how they do this, and they do the quantity of food. Well, how does the dance work? So the distance measurement is, first of all, they somehow take a picture analysis of where they're going, and then they translate this distance that they've gone, taking into account wind. So obviously, if you're a bee, you don't have like a GPS saying kilometers, right? So what they're doing is, if it takes more energy to get to the plant, they're going to adjust their dance to reflect the fact that it would appear to be longer than without wind. Now, if it was 100 yards or 100 meters, it would be 10 revolutions in 15 seconds. They do a figure eight. I'm going to show that. And if it's 3 kilometers, it's 3 revolutions in 15 seconds. Now you know all bees have little watches, and it's a bee watch, and they're watching the. No, bees don't have watches. Oh, well, somehow they're calculating time because they're doing this very specifically and very successfully, and they're measuring the distance based watching the bee do this number 8. And I'll show you a little video now that we got that working. The quantity is the intensity of the dance. So it's a little dance, it's called the Weggle dance, and they basically, you'll see them, they shift their bum, their behind, their bum, their behind, and they shift it like this, really fast, and the faster it goes, the more bees go. Somehow they calculate this. Then there's the question of direction, and the direction is based on where the sun is outside the hive. They're on the hive, and they use the hive in its hexagonal form as a point of reference. And then they take the number of degrees in left or right from that point of reference of where the sun is. And if the dance goes on for a while, they'll actually change the direction of the dance with the movement of the sun from within the hive. Okay. This is like overkill for getting honey. So let's see.
Honeybees have some fascinating abilities. Among them being able to communicate by performing a unit dance. It informs hive mates where a newly discovered food source is located. Every cycle of this waggle dance roughly describes the shape of the figure eight. Let's rewind and look in more detail. The bee only waggles on a part of its route, the stroke run, indicated here by the waved line. The secret lies in the direction of the straight run, or to be more precise, in the angle between the straight run and the perpendicular, which in this case is 90 degrees to the left. This tells the other bees that food is available 90 degrees to the left of the sun. If the angle is 60 degrees to the right, they'll be flying 60 degrees to the right of the sun.
Okay, so this is a pretty advanced way of just trying to get a meal. But we know this is more important than just getting a meal. We have what's called bee's knees. Who's heard that expression before? Eh? Bee's knees. Okay, those are bee's knees. But anyway, this is a real bee's knee. And you notice it has a pocket, has a pollen basket. And what happens is when it goes and gets the nectar, it bends down, opens the knee, takes in the pollen in the knee, flies away, goes to the next plant, goes to get more nectar, bends its knee, the pollen comes out, and it starts pollinizing the other plants. And here's an example of a knee full of pollen. And this is responsible for like 60% of our food chain. In other words, no bees. We lose 60% of our food, vegetables, and mainly fruit. So hyper important grains. There's lots of things that are done with bees, and it seems like it's symbiotic, right? This whole system can't evolve. It has to all be there at once. It's holistic, and that's the whole thing. Is if those verses we read on Genesis show an environment that's holistically working immediately, it's immediately working. It has to. We can't get it to work up progressively. Everything has to be there functional. But it's not only functional, it's over-designed. Let's talk a little bit more about symbiosis. So yucca moss and yucca plant, they're specific. In the case of bees, they go to multiple plants. In the case of the yucca, there's one moth. It's called a yucca moth that is the only thing that's going to pollinate the yucca. No yucca moss, no yucca. No yucca, no yucca moths. So, sounds like a sort of song. Anyway, each yucca species is pollinated by its own yucca moth species, so it's a specific. The yucca flower hangs down, so it cannot self-pollinate. See, if it's up, the pollination could fall in on itself, like some plants do that, they self-pollinate. But in this case, flower is down, so it's not going to self-pollinate, so it needs some help. The yucca moth does not need to, the moth doesn't actually need to eat, because they have a really short life plan. They have a special tentacle for organs designed for gathering and carrying pollen. They actually go and carry the pollen. And here's the cool thing, is that the female moth flies to another plant, pierces the ovary, deposits her eggs. That's all she needs to do. But then she moves down the situs until she gets the stigma where she puts in the pollen and then takes it to another plant. But she doesn't actually need to do that for her survival, except that she needs the plant to be able to survive. But, you know, it's not necessary. How does she know to do that? Pre-programmed. How do the bees know to do trigonometry? It's pre-programmed. It screams of creation. The larvae eat part of the seed, and the rest of the seeds continue to propagate the yucca seed. Now, here's another example of symbiosis. You would think that bird is in a very bad position. But in fact, that bird is eats, it's the toothbrush of the crocodile. The plover eats the leftovers, and the crocodile doesn't have to go to a dentist. And so this is a symbiotic relationship. Another bird wouldn't be in a good position here. This bird is. The examples are endless. It's endless. That's why Paul said they willingly are ignorant. They refuse to recognize it because it's really difficult not to see that there's a creator, an intelligence behind the creation. Really, really difficult. Let's talk about for a second about birds. The woodpecker. So, we have three. You probably have the same three here or more, but I remember they like to, they hit with their beak, especially when they're mating, and they don't really care whether it's a tree or not, so they'll go to your metal eaves trough and in the spring. So, that's their way of communicating. They can beat at a rate of 20 beats per second. So you can think of this, if a second is like 1,001 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi. So you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then you got 16, and then 20, it's 5. Okay, I'm a trumpet player. We don't usually do 5 beats in a, except in jazz. So 20 beats a second is really fast, right? That sort of thing. And then they do this 20,000 times a day. Well, think of this. They actually close their eyes between every hit. They're doing this. Why are they doing this? To get food, right? Their food is the insect in the tree. That's why they're just not doing this to make noise. So, but they have to close their eyes. Why do they have to close their eyes? Anybody know? Aside from Rob. Many people say that. It's actually not, as far as we know, it's not because of the wood chips. But it's a great idea. Yeah. The momentum is great. No, it'll affect their eyes. It's like a cartoon, where the eyes pop out of the head. Well, in this case, they would never come back in. So so they close their eyes at that speed. They do their eyes, keep the eyes in their head. Now, you would think that if you're going to hit a tree 20 beats a second for 20,000 times a day, you'd think you'd have a problem with a headache. You'd think, don't do this at home, right? Don't go hit your head on a wall. Okay, well, but they don't. They don't. Why don't they? Their brain is cushioned and protected so it does not move. So you get a concussion. Yeah, I remember. I came close to getting a concussion when I was going out with my girlfriend. And when you have a girlfriend, you have a marketing thing going on, right? You don't show the real me. You wouldn't do that. So you want to show the other me. After you get married, that's another deal. But before, you got this marketing. So you're walking along the street and you're keeping your eyes on your girlfriend. You're smiling. You're doing the whole thing, and you forget that there's a telephone post right in the middle of the. And you're just going on and boom, and she's laughing and laughing, and you're like, oh boy, I didn't impress anybody. Well, so what's the danger there is that our brain is in water, and so when you hit something, it stops. The brain actually moves in our head, and that's what creates a concussion. In the case of the woodpecker, it's completely cushioned, and in fact, they're studying woodpecker heads to see if they can make hockey helmets to be more efficient at protecting. Their feet are, and this is our new word for the day, zygodactyl. Let's say that's all they are. Zygodactyl. Okay, zygodactyl. Now you'll sound really smart. You don't know what it means, but that sounds smart. The way the feet are made, you have two up and two down, and it helps them go. You can see it here. So instead of having three, like most birds, you'll have three and one back. They have two up and two down, so they can move up and down the tree on the vertical. All right, very specific, many specific things. Now, let's keep going, because we haven't got to... They make the hole, but then what? Well, then they have to go get the insect. That takes a tongue. Their tongue is more than 2 to 3 times the length of their bill. And it goes around the inside of their head, and it divides into two. So it starts from the back of the nostril, divides into two, and comes out the beak. All right. I'm telling you, this is over-designed. Has barbs to catch the insect at the end. There's glue on the tongue. So it comes in, they have like a glue that as it goes out to get the insect, it's glued. Now, of course, you'd think that'd be a problem when it came back. Well, you can't evolve this because you only have one chance. either it works or you're dead. So solvent, right? It dissolves the tongue. They have a solvent. When it comes back, tongue spits into two again, And they get the insect, and they can actually feel vibrations through the end of their tongue to follow the insects in, once they're inside the tree. Sounds a little bit overkill, wouldn't you think? Just to get an insect, does he, can this play? See, does this play? So there's a pileated woodpecker doing a going to get those insects in there. So it just gives you some idea. All right, let's keep going. Let's take a swim. We've been walking. Let's take a little swim. Let's talk, you know, we talked a bit about the quick plane, right? We talked about flight, and you can think of flight in birds. You can think of flight in mammals, right? You have bats. We saw them at the Vancouver Aquarium yesterday. Dave and I went out to the aquarium. But you don't normally think about them in fish. So, flying fish, Barbados. Dave actually comes from Barbados, right? And they're flying fish there. And you'll notice that there's a fossil of flying fish here. Fossil record is a clear, strong proponent of creationism because you don't see evolution anywhere in the fossil record. Nothing changes. You see the fossils, you can identify them today. That's a fossil fish. It should be, like, I don't know, 40 million years old. It hasn't changed. Well, because there wasn't any evolution. That's why. But let's take a... I'll just show the beginning of this video so you can see you'll actually see the fish come out of the water. They glide about 400 meters, 1,300 feet, 70 kilometers an hour. And then get up to about 20 feet, about 6 meters. You'll see them come out. These aren't animations. These are the fish. You actually catch them by putting your net above the water. Right? Yeah. Maybe that's the problem I'm having with fishing. I got to put the net above the water. So, come out of nowhere. There's no evolution to this fish. There's no, like, pre-fish like this. It just... Okay. So, stop there. Adapted for airborne escape. Adapted? They, like, decided on their own? Oh, we need to get away from this. Let's grow some fins and start flying. That doesn't happen. It's not genetically valid. Okay, now we got flying snakes. Well, it's actually gliding snakes, but we got... Watch this. But they're actually shaped so they can glide. There we go. I can see that the chapter 3 of Genesis is very working here. There will be enmity between them. Yes, okay. All right. So, yeah, I like it. I mean, I'm not there, but I sort of think it's cool seeing this thing. It bends its body so it becomes aerodynamic, and then it floats. Cool. All right. How about an octopus? It's a mimic octopus.
But it could morph its shape in an instant to appear as seemingly any animal around it. At first, no one had any idea what it was.
The first time I saw it, I just was blown away. You couldn't get a more spectacular animal. It really is the pinnacle of wizardry.
Biologist Mark Norman was the first scientist to study this seemingly shapeless creature. He named it the mimic octopus.
The mimic octopus makes itself look like a living, moving animal. So it pulls all its arms around behind its body and swims along like a poisonous clownfish called a banded sole. In other cases, if it's getting attacked, it puts six arms down a hole and raises the other two arms to look like a poisonous sea snake that has bands along its body. If that's not enough, it'll swim along looking like a poisonous lionfish with these banded arms looking like the banded spines that come off these very deadly fish.
So far, 15 separate species are known to be in the mimic octopus act, and Norman is not always sure exactly what the mimic is doing. He observed this mimic scuttling along the sea bottom, looking something like a furry turkey.
Yeah. That's the question. Where did it come from? They don't have the answer, obviously. 15 different species. Imitates 15 different species. It's pre-programmed. It didn't learn this by looking at them. Some of them don't even live in their environment. Okay, here's another one called the... it's another octopus called the camouflage octopus. The camouflage octopus, it obviously looked completely like the plant, well, actually the animal it was in, and it just disappeared. So we can go on and on, but you see, you don't have to be very educated necessarily to be able to recognize quickly that we've been created. It doesn't make sense to think that this kind of thing came about by cosmic chance. It's not rational. It's not logical. You know, Job had in the book of Job, we have this discussion here where it even says this is where we should find some of this information. Job 12, 7 to 9. But ask now the beasts, and they will teach you. Ask the fowls of the air, the birds of the sky, they will tell you. Speak to the earth, and it'll teach you. And the fish of the sea, they'll declare to you. Who knows not in these that the hand of the Lord has done this. You know what I mean? It's clear that this is, wow. I quote the Living Bible here just so it's easier. Psalms 40:4-5 says, many blessings are given to those who trust the Lord and have no confidence in those who are proud or trust in idols. O Lord, my God, many and many a time you have done great miracles for us, and we are ever in your thoughts. Who else can do such glorious things? No one else can be compared to you. There isn't time to tell of all your wondrous deeds. That's really what I feel when the more I investigate and learn about the creation. And, of course, we haven't gone into us so much. We have Psalms 139:14, which says, you know, I praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth well. When I was at university, one of my professors who knew I was a creationist said, I'm not a creationist because of my knee. What? He said, well, you know, I have a bad knee. Okay, first of all, the argument is not a good argument. I mean, even if you have a... I don't know if anybody here remembers Ladas, the car called Lada. Okay, even if you have a really bad, shoddy car, no one's going to say that car wasn't designed. Okay, which is what he's trying to say, it wasn't designed. But now we know it's working pretty well, his knee... But because of the fall and because of things breaking down, it's not working as well as it was designed to work. And some things don't work as well when we use them a lot. Those of us who are older will understand that. And so we are marvelously made. The knee is extremely, extremely complex. Now, as we finish up here, I want to talk for a second about butterfly metamorphosis. Butterflies are complete. I've always, in all my debates, when I first started doing debates about 2000, you have to have the opportunity to do a debate. You have to have someone who's willing to debate. We were trying to organize a debate on this tour, and we ended up not. I guess you gave them the YouTube links of my previous debates, and they said no. But if you write my name, Lawrence Tisdall Debate, on YouTube, you'll see one I did with Michael Corn on the Michael Corn Show in 2007. About 700,000 people have watched it. And what's so interesting is when you get to the 42nd minute, I realized that when I was on the show, I realized I was answering all the questions. And Jason Wiles, the evolutionist, he was getting off scot-free. So I took over the show. I turned over and said, Jason, give me some evidence for evolution. He said, I've got lots of evidence. I said, okay, give me some evidence. He said, there's lots of evidence. I said, yeah, give me one. And he said, there's lots of evidence. And Michael Korn, no dummy, he said, we're going to take a break so that Jason can... Okay, well, Jason just lost the debate. Clearly, that was it. It's over. He's doing his doctorate on evolutionary education. But he couldn't answer the question, give me evidence. Now, he did find some but after the break, and I responded to it, the two. But this is the whole thing, is that they don't even think through their theory, because it's like, it's a given. Well, the problem is, butterfly metamorphosis is not a given. You have to have an insect creature that has a genetic code that doesn't have to do with the other part. You understand? The caterpillar is a stomach, a walking stomach. And then it becomes a larva. It has to all be pre-coded to have the larva, and then it sort of suicides itself. And then pieces are revamped, and then it becomes a butterfly, which does continental migrations. Wait a second, you've got a bunch of genetic code that doesn't even reproduce. You understand? How do you even add or do anything in a model where the creature doesn't reproduce? The butterfly reproduces, but not the caterpillar. So how do you get this information that's totally different? It's like you've got two complete different organisms with the code in the same cells. My question to evolution is always how. It's not my idea. It's their idea. So this is a fantastic over-design. It's audacious. It's amazing. And you know, we have a metamorphosis too. And 2 Corinthians 5:17 says, therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. I mean, that's what metamorphosis is, transforming into a new creature. Old things are passed away, and behold, all things are become new. And that's what Christ wants us to do. He wants us to go through that metamorphosis of getting rid of the caterpillar and going towards the butterfly. And God has created us for us to be changed and into His image, and that's His goal. And so my last slide as we finish up. Last two slides. Psalms 119:27. Make me to understand the way of thy precepts, so shall I talk of thy wondrous works. We've got to talk to people about creation. It's so easy. You know, in Quebec, you can't do the concept. There's a concept with Answers in Genesis that's Bible first. No, Bible means nothing in Quebec. No one's Christian. There's 49%, the latest poll that came out last week or a week before, 49% declared atheist. It's highest in North America, I believe. So you don't, Bible first, you have to build it like Paul does in Acts 17. You have to build from something that we can communicate on. And science, I don't know if you noticed it, but scientists have replaced, in our community, have replaced the pastors and the priests. And they declare truth. Otherwise, why would Volkswagen put a mechanic with a white lab coat in their ad? No mechanic wears a white lab coat. Really. But you're supposed to think it's truth. And so this is the whole thing, is that they've given over their mindset to this, and we need to get rid of that and just focus on what is true, and then think all kinds of beauty opens up. And I'll finish with this. Oh, that's what I was. I just did that. This one. And every creature which is in heaven and on earth. Actually, if you permit that, what I'd like to do, you can say no, because we haven't talked about it. would it be okay if we just stood up and said that? Like a sort of, because it's scripture. But we're not going to sing it because I don't have a song. But if you would, we can stretch a bit. We're going to be sitting down for a couple times today. If we could just stand up and I conclude, and I'll pass it back to the pastor. I'd like us all to say together Revelation 5:13, where we really give honor to the Lord for His creation. Is that okay? All right, let's do this. And every creature which is in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and such as are in the sea and all that in them, heard I saying, blessing and honor and glory and power be unto Him that sitteth upon the throne and unto the Lamb forever and ever. Thank you.